My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Ukraine accuses Russia of attacking a theater full of civilians. Moscow denies the attack. Plus, Putin says he can protect Russia's economy from sanctions. But how realistic are his plans? And light at the end of the tunnel after months of talks to revive the Iran nuclear deal.
The deal is very likely to happen in the coming days. We really are now clear for the U.S. and Iran to resolve the final differences.
It's Thursday, March 17th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Officials in Ukraine say a Russian airstrike hit a theater in the city of Mariupol, in which hundreds of civilians were sheltering. Russia has denied attacking the theater. Meanwhile, President Biden escalated his rhetoric during a White House event when a reporter asked about his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. Biden directly called Putin a war criminal. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The president's remarks speak for themselves. He was speaking from his heart and speaking from what he's seen on television, which is barbaric actions by a brutal dictator.
A Kremlin spokesman said Biden's comment was unacceptable and unforgivable, according to Russian state media. A U.S. appeals court has cleared the Biden administration to use higher dollar value estimates about the cost of climate change in setting government policy. It's the latest twist in the administration's efforts to adopt a more than sevenfold increase in the social cost of carbon, a metric that assigns a dollar value to the harm caused by greenhouse gas emissions. The decision reverses a federal judge's ruling last month that blocked the use of the proposed cost increase. COVID-19 new hospital admissions in the U.S. are reaching their lowest recorded level after any prior surge, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of federal data. But U.S. health experts are keeping a close eye on rising COVID-19 caseloads in parts of Europe. The U.K. is of particular concern because trends there usually precede those in the U.S. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus says rising cases around the world show the pandemic is not over.
After several weeks of declines, reported cases of COVID-19 are once again increasing globally, especially in parts of Asia. These increases are occurring despite reductions in testing in some countries, which means the cases we're seeing are just the tip of the iceberg.
And we are exclusively reporting that Microsoft is facing an antitrust complaint in Europe involving its cloud services. French cloud computing company OVH Cloud filed the complaint with the European Commission, the EU's top competition regulator. The complaint focuses on the way Microsoft licenses its products, such as its Office productivity suite, that may make it more expensive to use cloud services that compete with Microsoft's own Azure cloud, sources say. A Microsoft spokesman wouldn't immediately confirm whether the company had been notified of the complaint, but said European cloud companies are building successful businesses using Microsoft's products. Russian President Vladimir Putin has acknowledged the impact of Western sanctions on the country's economy. He's now saying Russia needs deep structural changes that won't be easy. He's also promised a long list of ambitious policies to turn around the Russian economy. But how realistic are they? WSJ Markets reporter Anna Hertenstein joins us with the story. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Luke.
All right. What has President Putin said about the state of the Russian economy? I understand he'd previously been pretty hesitant to acknowledge, for instance, the impact of sanctions.
He spoke on television and said the West has tried to organize an economic blitzkrieg. And you're right, this was the first time that he really acknowledged the hit to the Russian economy from the Western sanctions.
Okay, so what is Putin's plan to right the ship?
He's put out a whole raft of measures. These include things like increased payments to pensioners and state employees, a rise in the minimum wage, and financial assistance to businesses. And that's because the purchasing power of ordinary Russians has really been eroded after these sanctions. That's because there's been a deep devaluation of the ruble. It traded at record lows. And while it's recovered a bit, it's still depreciated around 28% against the dollar since the beginning of the year.
And has Putin said what the impact of passing these measures might be on the Russian economy and whether they're enough to actually turn things around?
It still remains to be seen, but he has said that it won't be easy, they'll lead to rises in inflation and unemployment. And you are actually seeing this already. Russian consumers are seeing higher consumer prices and shortages in some stores. We actually heard that consumer prices in Russia have risen by 5.6% since the start of the year. And that's over the country's 4% target for the entire year. So you are seeing a real hit already.
And in these same remarks, Putin seemed to offer an olive branch to foreign companies that had left Russia in recent weeks. What is the possibility that anything he could do could convince them to return?
That also remains to be seen. Western companies, including major corporations like Boeing, McDonald's, Volkswagen, and others, have pulled back from Russia. And that's either to comply with sanctions or because of public pressure and public anger over the war in Ukraine. So as long as there's sanctions that prevent them from being able to operate, they'll likely stay away. I mean, very few companies want to have to deal with sanctions risk. But there's also a risk that they stay away for longer and self-sanction even after, because there's now a reputational risk to working in Russia. So we'll just see how long that lasts.
That was WSJ Markets reporter Anna Hertenstein. Anna, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, a revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal could be signed within days after several breakthroughs this week. But the circumstances surrounding the deal, from Iran's nuclear knowledge to the West's need for its oil, are very different than they were when the agreement was first signed. We've got that story after the break.
My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal took a major step forward this week after Russia relaxed sanctions-related demands that had been seen as jeopardizing an agreement. Under the 2015 deal, Iran agreed to stop its nuclear weapons program, receiving in return international sanctions relief, including the ability to sell its oil to international markets. But the Trump administration took the U.S. out of the accord and reimposed sweeping sanctions on Iran, saying the accord was too weak. Now, after almost a year of on-again, off-again talks to revive the deal, could a breakthrough be close at hand? The WSJ's Lawrence Norman has been following the talks, and he joins us today from Berlin. Lawrence, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Where are we now in these negotiations? It seems a significant sticking point has been removed thanks to Russia here. Does that mean a deal is imminent?
I think a deal is very likely to happen in the coming days, possibly even by the Iranian New Year, which starts on Sunday. We really are now clear for the US and Iran to resolve the final differences, which are over the exact sanctions that the US will lift. And if that's resolved, then this could all be tied up very quickly.
And so if an agreement is reached, the 2015 nuclear deal will be revived. Just remind us what that deal entailed and what will change if this is agreed to.
So essentially, the 2015 deal lifted most international sanctions on Iran in exchange for very tight restrictions on Iran's nuclear work for a number of years, but those restrictions will expire eventually. Many US sanctions on Iran were kept in place, however. So that will free up a lot of Iran's economy, energy sector, financial and business sector to do business with the world again once the deal is re-implemented.
So if the deal goes through, Iran would be able to sell oil again to international markets. What impact could that have in an environment where oil prices have just been spiking?
Yeah, so the immediate impact would probably be a drop in prices on the conclusion of a deal because of the prospect of a big increase in Iranian supply coming on way. Now, we need to be a little careful. This deal will be implemented over several months, and it may well be that the U.S. only fully lift sanctions on Iran's oil supplies at the end of the implementation, which would be in the summer. And that would allow Iran to properly sell as much oil as it wishes and repatriate the dollars that it is paid for that oil from foreign countries. We can expect a market impact initially, but the bigger impact will be in a few months' time when Iranian oil comes properly back on the market.
Where are we now in terms of Iran's nuclear program, perhaps compared to where we were in the lead up to that prior deal?
So what we know about the way they've improved the work that they've done is all about the production of nuclear fuel. The key question and the key unknown is how ready is Iran to actually build a nuclear weapon, a warhead, and attach it to a ballistic missile that it could fire somewhere else. And there are different estimates on that. The US, the CIA Chief Bill Burns said in December there is no evidence that Iran is currently working on weaponizing nuclear fuel, in other words, on building a nuclear weapon. And most estimates are that Iran is probably between 1 to 2 years away from being able to build a sophisticated nuclear weapon. But ultimately, no one is quite sure.
And Lawrence, how much did the war in Ukraine end up becoming a part of the negotiations?
The nuclear talks, going right back to the beginning in 2013, have been remarkable by their ability to insulate themselves from events, from the Syrian conflict to Russia's annexation of Crimea, and for most of the last year, for the growing tensions between the US and both China and Russia. The Ukraine conflict since late February really did seep into the talks, and what we saw was Russia delivering some last-minute demands that really could have scuttled the deal, could have made it impossible. The Russians softened those demands on Tuesday, and we seem to have gotten over that hurdle. But yeah, Ukraine and the Ukraine conflict has become life-threatening to this deal, but it looks as if it will probably still get over the line.
And if this deal is actually agreed, can it survive the very tense global environment that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, I think that's a very pertinent question. There's all kinds of death row moments for this deal, potentially, in the next few years. There's obviously the Ukraine conflict, if it were to get worse, and somehow that would break the implementation. In June, there will be a very important moment, which is probably before the deal gets fully re-implemented, when the Iranians want the UN Atomic Agency to drop an investigation into nuclear material found in Iran. If the agency do not drop that investigation, the Iranians have privately warned that they may not fully re-implement the deal. And then, of course, when there's midterm elections in the US, the possibility that Republicans can gain control of Congress and start floating new sanctions on Iran. And, of course, everyone is very aware, as that almost all leading Republicans have said, if they retake the White House in January 2025, that they would kill the deal again. So this deal, even if it's agreed, and even if it does get through implementation in June, its life may not be all that long.
That was the WSJ's Lawrence Norman joining us today from Berlin. Lawrence, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And finally, the ripple effects of Russia's war in Ukraine are trickling through to the arts. Many Western cultural organizations, from regional film festivals to New York's Metropolitan Opera, are now starting to distance themselves from Russian artists and performers. Some of those performers have defended President Vladimir Putin, but others have not spoken out, fearing their careers could be jeopardized. Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen says the decision about whether to cut ties with Russian performers and their works is dividing the art world.
I think you have this really split idea between the idea that art should be above the fray and should transcend geopolitics and war and should be an instrument of connecting civilizations no matter what happens. And then the very real concerns of official organizations that are responsible for what they present on stage, that they feel that they are historically important and will be looked at that way in hindsight.
And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.